Welcome to the Journal.ie's The Explainer, where every week we take a deep dive into a different news story. I'm Laura Byrne, and this week, how do judges in Ireland decide on sentencing in a case? Now, the wheels of the busy Irish justice system turn every day, processing the headline-grabbing cases of the Central Criminal Courts or the smaller everyday cases of the Circuit and District Courts. Verdicts come via a jury-based court sitting or judge only, as with the Special Criminal Court and Supreme Court, for example, but it is down to judges to come up with a sentence for any defendants convicted of a crime. The public's reaction to those sentences can vary depending on the case, and that often results in political pressure. We'll have seen our new Taoiseach Simon Harris, for instance, and others within Fine Gael promising something of a return to the party's law and order roots in recent weeks. So let's just look at how sentencing works. What guidance do judges get on the severity of these sentences? And how is it that some judges deliver sentences that look very different to those of their peers? To discuss all of this today, I'm joined by Paul McCutcheon, who's a professor of law at University of Limerick. Thanks so much for joining us today, Paul.
How are you?
Paul, could you give us some examples of cases that were of interest, not so much for the verdict maybe, but for the sentencing handed down?
The courts, particularly the Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court, have delivered a number of judgments in which they're called guideline judgments, in which they give guidance to judges for a particular type of offence. So, for example, manslaughter, which is unlawful killing that is not murder, essentially. The maximum sentence for manslaughter is life imprisonment, but it could be anything from life down to a suspended sentence and no time served in jail. So in the relevant case, the Supreme Court classified manslaughter into four categories. The highest category, the category of worst culpability, they said the sentence should be 15 to 20 years. Then the next category is about 10 to 15 years. The third category is 4 to 10. And the lowest category, the minimum culpability, is 0 to 4 years. And then they gave indicators of what type of killing, what type of manslaughter would fit into the category 1, category 2, etc. And in the main, the most serious category are killings that fall marginally short of murder. And at the lower end, they are killings that are maybe just above rough horseplay or a minor assault gone wrong. Now, what then is required? These are what we call headline sentences. So the judge trying a case will decide, is this manslaughter in category 1, 2, 3, or 4? And then we'll pick the headline sentence, which is an indicative sentence. So we'll say the judge says the headline sentence is 8 years. Then the judge will apply mitigation or aggravation, but more usually it's mitigation, and likely adjust the sentence downwards. And then at the end, the judge applies what we call the totality principle. The judge looks at it in the round and says, let us, in our hypothetical example, it goes down to 5.5 years. The judge says, does that feel right? Is that the type of sentence that's appropriate to this type of manslaughter? So that's the structure of the process and how guidance is given by the appeal courts.
And what would you say that the purpose is of sentencing offenders like that, that it's not just a static X amount of years for X crime?
Okay, well, there are a number of purposes associated with punishment that are recognised by Irish law. One is retribution, the idea that the person has done a wrong and deserves punishment for that reason. Now, some people, it used to be referred to as vengeance. Nowadays, people talk about just deserts, that the offender's wrongdoing deserves a quantum of punishment. The second purpose is deterrence, either what we call special deterrence to deter the particular offender. If you've been punished once, you're unlikely, we hope, to do it again. Our general deterrence, that by punishing one offender, you deter the public at large, or the populace at large. Rehabilitation is also seen as a purpose, and that you look for the possibility that the offender might be cured of his or her offending ways. So they're the three main purposes recognised by Irish law. There's a fourth purpose that Irish law disregards. It's called incapacitation. The idea that the sentence should disable the offender from offending. In other words, lock him up and he can't do anything. That is not recognized by Irish law. The other three are. And they factor in various ways. And sometimes a judge will emphasize deterrence. Another time the judge will emphasize retribution or just desert.
Now, you did touch on some of the guidelines that judges have to follow and they have a certain amount of discretion. But broadly speaking, what does a judge have to consider when deciding what sentence to hand down?
Okay, well, where there are guideline judgments, and we don't have guideline judgments for every offence, but there's a growing number of them. So we've guideline, as I mentioned, for manslaughter. We have judgments for offences like dangerous driving causing death or serious injury, for burglary, for assault causing harm, and so forth. So where there is a guideline judgment, the judge is expected to adhere to that. So as I said, the process, he decides what range was the offending. The guideline judgment has given you an indicative sentence, you know, from, as I say, 8 to 10 or 5 to 8 or whatever years it happens to be. The judge selects that, as I said, as the headline sentence and then applies mitigation aggravation. So what are the mitigating factors? They would largely relate to the circumstances of the offender and the offender's attitude. So standard mitigation, an early guilty plea, demonstration of remorse, a willingness to compensate the victim or to make good the wrong done. Other factors might be the personal factors related to the offender, the offender's background, educational status, lack of opportunity, addictive status, etc.
And when we look at tougher and longer sentences, what are the aggravating factors then when they look at the defendant?
The aggravating factors will include lack of remorse, you might say bad attitude, sometimes refusal to accept a verdict can be seen as aggravating. The use of additional violence or gratuitous violence. You know, a lot of offences are in their nature violent, but if the defendant uses more violence than is normally associated with that offence, that aggravates. For example, during a theft, if the offender strikes the property owner, well, that's an aggravating factor. Prior record is an aggravating factor as well.
And Paul, we've heard a lot in the last few years, particularly in high profile cases, about victim impact statements. Did they have an impact on the judge's decision eventually?
The impact on a victim would be a factor that goes to determining the range in which the offence is, mid-range or high range. So here's an example. An elderly person is attacked in their home, and as a result, they can't live in their home anymore, or they are especially fearful. That will come out in the victim impact statement, which is delivered at, you know, at sentencing stage. But the judge will also be aware of that, and that would be a thing that might aggravate the offence. So vulnerability of the victim and the consequences for a victim are, it can be aggravating factors.
What's the history then of this discretion? Because we often hear the public reacting differently to how certain judges interpret sentencing. Some are seen often as more lenient than others, let's say. Why does that discretion then exist within the judicial system?
Well, several reasons. First of all, the law has always allowed discretion. We with very few exceptions, the law has avoided mandatory sentences. Okay, we have mandatory life for murder and for treason. For all the other serious offences, it's imprisonment up to life or up to 14 years or whatever the law sets as a maximum. And it is a recognition, I think, that even though the offence is the same, that the offending within that offence can vary. You can have serious manslaughters that fall just short of murder, and you can have manslaughters that are just above messing and horseplay. They're the same offence, but they're very different in their degree of culpability. And in this respect, proportionality is a cardinal principle and is arguably constitutionally enshrined. And there's a constitutional requirement that punishment be proportionate to the offending.
Now, you mentioned mandatory sentencing for crimes such as murder. Can a judge ever go beyond what's set out in legislation when handing down such a sentence?
No. The legislation sets the maximum. So, for example, the maximum penalty for burglary is 14 years. So if you could imagine the worst burglary ever, you're still capped at 14 years. That's what the law states.
And when you talk about life, mandatory life for murder, it isn't life in prison, is it? A lot of people listening might think, well, that must be for the end of their natural life, but that's not the case.
Well, no, the sentence is a life sentence and is served for the remainder of the prisoner's life. Now, the prisoner may be released from prison after so many years. I think the average is about 17 or 18 years served at the moment. But the prisoner who is released in that manner, that's an executive matter, not a judicial matter. But the prisoner who is released is still under sentence. And, for example, it could be reactivated or it could be recalled. So just to understand that although a prisoner is released before the expiration of the sentence, the prisoner is still serving that sentence. And as I say, it can be reactivated. The prisoner can be recalled to prison.
And Paul, when we look at the Irish sentencing system, I am minded of maybe jurisdictions like US where you see incredibly long sentences there. How do we compare to other countries?
Okay, that's hard to tell because for a couple of reasons, getting sentencing data is actually quite a tricky issue. It's a very complicated issue. And to get the type of data set that people need to say, well, on average, what are people doing getting for burglary or for theft or for assault causing harm? The system is working towards that, but the information, it'll take time to systematize and absorb. That's the caveat. The impression one would have comparing Ireland to American jurisdictions is, first of all, yeah, American legislation tends to provide for much heavier punishment than in Ireland. And you do read of cases or come across cases where a person is sentenced to 375 years. And you laugh, you know, what's the purpose of that? He's hardly going to make parole in those circumstances. You also have three strikes and you're out provisions in a number of American states. You commit three felonies, you're in prison for life. I think the view in Ireland is that that would be disproportionate and then potentially unconstitutional. I mean, if you took the equivalent of a felony, theft would be the American equivalent of a felony. A person is on that rationale, potentially a person who steals three bicycles could end up in prison for the rest of his life. And I don't think any decent person would consider that reasonable or proportionate.
Now, there is a lot of discussion around reform of sentencing in political circles and in legal circles. What type of reform is possible here?
Okay. Well, in political circles, very often by reform, they mean just jacking up maximum penalties. That's really what they mean. So moving 10 years to 14 years, 14 years to 20 years. And that very often is done in an inconsiderate, almost knee-jerk response. So what reform can be done? There is provision under the Judicial Council Act that one of the subcommittees of the Judicial Council is the Sentencing Subcommittee. That's not her full title. They are undertaking the process of preparing guidelines for judges. So across all the range of criminal offences. I understand that at present it's the data management exercise, get as much information as you possibly can, then trying to code that data to see, for example, not all burglaries are the same, so you've got to try and classify the different types of burglary into high, middle, low, and then to work out what are the sentences being given. And ultimately, the judiciary as a collective would vote to accept those guidelines or not, and if they do, then they'd become the operable guidelines in court. What I can say, though, is that, okay, this work is ongoing, but it's a long project. The judges are amenable to this. Judges trying criminal cases want as much information. They do want guidance. They want to get pointers to say, is this the right sentence or is that the right sentence? And they want to be as consistent as they can, allowing for the fact that the circumstances of particular cases can differ. That would be an important reform. Not as spectacular as a quick hit of changing legislation to increase penalties for this, that, or the other, but it would be a more enduring reform and one that would, I suppose, give reassurance that there is a framework of consistency.
And you touched on the political knee-jerk reaction there and making sentences longer, but do you think in any real terms it acts as any great deterrent?
Probably not. For the serious offences, probably not. I mean, the penalty for assault causing harm recently, in last year or so, I can't remember, was increased from 5 to 10 years. Will that deter a fellow with drink on him and a bottle in his hand on a Friday night? I think not. Sometimes where deterrence can work in the way you describe, is for the person is in a position more rationally to calculate. So it has been argued that penalty points have improved driver behavior. Fixed penalty notices have improved driver behavior, notwithstanding the debate at this very moment about the increase in road debts and the question of enforceability. Arguably, that has had some effect. So the other important factor, I think you got to remember, Laura, is that the prospect of apprehension is a greater deterrent than the quantum of punishment, generally speaking. You know, again, going back to our fellow with drink on a Friday night and a bottle in his hand, if there's a guard standing in the street corner, he'll put the bottle away.
Now, when we look at the guidelines that the judiciary have in terms of sentencing, they are always independent, though, aren't they? When it comes to their decision on the day, they don't necessarily have to account for that decision.
Well, they do have to account in several ways. First of all, the judge has to give reasons. The judge has to set out the methodology he or she is employing. So the judge has to state, is this high, middle, low range? And why the judge is reaching that conclusion, and then set the headline sentence. And then as the judge aggravates or mitigates, must give reasons. Why am I adding to the sentence for aggravation, or why am I subtracting from the sentence for mitigation? These judgments are appealable. So that's another form of accountability. And sometimes the Court of Appeal will look and they'll say, okay, the judge used the wrong methodology or approached the question of headline sentence inaccurately or incorrectly, and will set aside the sentence for that reason alone. So there is accountability in these ways.
Do the judges have to be careful when it comes to looking forward to appeal? It has been seen in some cases in the past where, let's say, the remarks by the judge in the final moments of sentencing might be called into question at the defendant's appeal.
Sometimes that has happened, yes, sometimes. But I think in the last number of years, as the superior courts have given sentence guidance and worked out the methodology I've just described, sentencing judges are applying that much more rigorously, and it gives them a framework within which to operate. So there is a lot of consistency in the way decisions are made, although it mightn't appear to be so when you just look at individual cases as reported from time to time.
You mentioned that judges do welcome guidelines on sentencing, but how do they react to the likes of the current government, say, tweaking the sentencing that we discussed earlier?
Oh, that's hard to tell. I mean, okay, it won't necessarily mean that the sentences handed down are going to be any greater. If you increase the penalty from 5 to 10 years, it mightn't in practice, but that takes time to work out. So, for example, in that regard, that example I picked deliberately, there was an assault causing harm guidance judgment some years ago. At the time, the maximum was 5 years. Now that the maximum was 10 years, maybe the Court of Appeal will have to revisit that matter and say, okay, the ground rules have changed. We've got to see how we tweak our guideline judgment or alter our guideline judgment. But again, you have to wait for the appropriate case to present itself.
Paul, what would you say is the area of sentencing that is in the most need of reform? We do hear a lot of discussion around sentencing for sexual offences, a lot of calls for reform in that area.
Sexual offences are, generally speaking, punished quite severely. So for the most serious sexual offences, rape, aggravated sexual assault, those type of offences against children, in general, a custodial sentence is going to be served. Even if there is a lot of mitigation for the offender, generally speaking, a custodial sentence will be handed down. So you will notice, say, some of the historic sex offences that might have happened 30, 40 years ago, where the defendant is in his 70s, early 80s. Ordinarily, the age of the offender is a mitigating factor. You have to take it into account. And in sexual offences, they will be taken into account, but not to the point where that guy doesn't serve jail time. And that is a recognition of the seriousness of the offence committed, that this type of offending merits imprisonment. In circumstances where if an 80-year-old were being sentenced for a different offence, say embezzlement or something like that, they might get a suspended sentence or a more lenient sentence. So I think what might be helpful, this isn't about reform of the law, is that greater understanding of the processes and what a sentence entails. So here's one that happens. A person gets a suspended sentence or a partially suspended sentence. A lot of people think he gets off. You know, he hasn't spent a day in jail, he got off. Actually, a suspended sentence is still a sentence of imprisonment. It can be reactivated. And you do come across cases for a sentence, a suspended sentence is reactivated. And as a sentence, it has the consequences for the offender in relation to, say, exclusion from certain professions, not getting a visa to go to certain countries and that. So it does have consequences.
Which I suppose is a difficult sell, isn't it, for the public? Because that's the nature of public opinion around certain high profile cases.
And it's an understandable reaction. If you see or read about a horrific piece of horrific offence with horrific offending, then the reaction is to say, you know, maximum punishment possible, that, you know, condign punishment is what is called for. But one of the rules of sentencing is to look at all the factors. You've got to look at everything and to maintain proportionality. Otherwise, you're getting closer to some sort of mob justice, which we don't want.
Well, it's very clear from what you've outlined to us today. It's a complex system and it's slow to change, and some reform is still needed. Look, thank you so much, Paul, for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Thanks again to Paul McCutcheon for joining us today. You've been listening to the Explainer podcast by thejournal.ie. This episode was brought to you by senior producer Nikki Ryan and executive producer Sinead O'Carroll. If you'd like to support all the work we do here, head to thejournal.ie/contribute to make a one-off donation or become a monthly subscriber. And of course, you can always leave a review and a rating wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.